never gone before.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Deanne Lunan, who is an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the NCLC's Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She assists attorneys representing low-income consumers and teaches consumer law to legal services, private consumer attorneys, and other advocates. Deanne is the author of the National Consumer Law Center's publication, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as numerous reports on the student loan industry and borrower issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deanne Lunan.
Thank you.
And there is a debt bomb ticking here in the United States from student loans. Student loan debt in the United States now totals more than $1 trillion, which is more than all of the outstanding credit card debt in the country. Do you see this as a sort of almost a replay of the subprime bubble that brought down Wall Street?
Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of similarities, particularly in the private student loan market, which is actually only a part of the total student loan market. There are government loans and also private student loans. But there was a flourishing subprime market on the private loan side pretty much at the same time that it was all happening on the mortgage side and the credit card side. And people are paying the price now, or trying to pay the price, basically stuck in debt just like they are on their homes and other credit.
So how did it get to the point, though, where the total student debt is $1 trillion, which is more than the outstanding credit card debt in the country?
Well, it's really a combination of factors that have been building over time. I mean, one thing is the cost of education, of higher education, has gone up exponentially over time. And I think anybody who's in college or has a child who's going to college or is pursuing higher education as an adult knows this. They know that college is expensive, and it's hard to figure out a way to pay for it. So at the same time that the cost has gone up, we've shifted as a policy matter from reliance more on grants, particularly for the lowest income students, to much more reliance on loans to pay for the education. So those two factors, combined with the poor economy and other problems with people actually getting what they paid for out of school, has led to this problem.
But what seems to be happening, though, here is so many of these graduates, and I'm not even talking about the for-profit schools, which is 90% taxpayer-funded. And I don't know whether you've noticed they're now advertising all over the place. So when people see advertising for these for-profit colleges, they ought to realize that that's their tax dollars being spent to advertise to get people in. And in many cases, they end up with worthless diplomas and huge student debts, much greater debts, because all that's happening here is taxpayer money is going through these shingles, if you will, and then they mark them up. You know, it would be so much more humane if the government just lent directly to students, which they do in terms of Pell Grants and other things. But what really I find deeply upsetting is that we're making, or this system is making so many of our fellow citizens, young aspirants, a lot of minority kids and an awful lot of vets, making them economically non-functional for the rest of their adult lives.
Right, and I think there's two points that we have to realize as a policy matter. One is that we really started the higher education financial aid programs back in the 60s, sort of part of the Great Society. The goal was to increase equal access to education. In other words, to close the gap between the lowest income individuals in society and higher income individuals so that everyone basically who's qualified would have the opportunity to go to college. And interestingly, unfortunately, that gap has actually grown over time. So there's fewer lower income individuals who are completing college over time, and there's only, it's only about 9% or so of lower income individuals who actually complete college. So the gap has grown, and I think that's one thing to look at is really a failure of policy. And at the same time, what we've done as a policy matter is we've made the consequences for people who don't succeed in school, who drop out, or who otherwise don't get what they paid for and aren't able to get a job to pay for the loans, we've made the consequences of that more and more draconian over time, so that it's almost impossible to escape student loan debt, and the consequences where the government can crack down on you have grown over time as well.
What's happened is that college seniors who've graduated with student loans in 2010 owed an average of $25,250, which is up 5% from the previous year. But the parents have an average of $34,000 in student loans for their children. A recent report from the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys said that the number of these parental loans has jumped 75% since 2006. So what you have here is a situation where it's both a problem for students and parents who have co-signed loans. And if the student defaults, the parent gets stuck with the bill and is hounded by the creditors. But then the student can't get a job, because every time they check, every time a student with a defaulted loan goes for a job interview, they run a credit check, and he gets or he or she is punished because of their default.
Right, and I think one thing is that that's true, particularly for that's kind of the traditional student where they do have parents who are able to help. And unfortunately, a lot of those parents are suffering their own economic problems right now. So even if they, at the time when they co-signed the loan, thought that they would be in a pretty good financial position to pay it back, a lot of the parents aren't in as good of a situation as they thought. And it's not just, you know, sort of the traditional young people who go to college. The majority of students now actually who go to higher education are what they call non-traditional students, older working adults, and they don't often even have parents who were able to co-sign in the first place, and they're suffering the same consequences trying to figure out a way to get a job and pay off the loans. If they do have federal loans, one sort of bright spot, it's not perfect, but at least people should know that there are options to help manage the debt. Not eliminated except in really extreme circumstances, but at least manage the debt during hard times. The private loans are much harder. There's very little relief available for those.
Well, that's what happened in 2005, right, under President Bush's bankruptcy reform, one of the few achievements of the Bush administration, apart from the Iraq War and the vast run-up in the debt and the Afghan War and the crash of the economy.
Right. I mean, it was very, very almost hidden in the overall overhaul of the bankruptcy system, that they made so many changes to it and made it so much harder for consumers to get relief through the bankruptcy system. They added a provision back in 2005 that made private student loans as difficult to discharge in bankruptcy as the government loans are. And the government loan bankruptcy provision actually hasn't been around forever either. It used to be easier for consumers to get relief from government loans in bankruptcy as well. But there's really no excuse, I mean, no reason to allow private lenders to have this, you know, additional help, really. It was a boon for the lenders that they can say to consumers who can't pay their private loans, well, you better come up with something because you're not going to be able to get relief in bankruptcy court.
So if you're a business that fails, you can file for bankruptcy. But if you're a college student or the parent of college students, you're hounded for life.
Yeah, and it's a pattern that's really just, there's no reason for it, and that's really why we fight so hard on behalf of student loan borrowers and the clients we work with. There's other things like the fact that for government student loans, the government can come after you forever. There's no statute of limitations, no time limit. And that's unprecedented. The only other areas where that really the government or can pursue you forever are for crimes like treason or murder. And so when in the policy debate we put student loan borrowers in that same grouping is really something that was a benefit for lenders and in some cases the schools, but it's certainly not something that is good for student borrowers.
So, Deanne, how did this for-profit college industry become such a hot business on Wall Street now. Wall Street's getting into the act. I understand that Kaplan, which is owned by the Washington Post, effectively subsidizes the Washington Post. There's clearly an enormous amount of money in this, in these private colleges. But President Obama tried to clean up the for-profit college industry because there was so much evidence that they were providing worthless diplomas and saddling kids with a lifetime of debt. And what happened to those reforms?
Yeah, well, it's a very sad story. And the for-profit industry, the school industry, has been around for a while. It's not new. And in fact, there was a crackdown back in the 90s. But what's new is the volume of schools and the amount of money that they're getting from the taxpayers and in the form of federal aid. And the reason that the schools have grown so much is because, as you mentioned, the Wall Street investment. Basically, most of the big companies are chains that are publicly traded companies, and Kaplan, for example, with the relation with the Washington Post and others. So the scope of the industry has grown over time. They're very, very aggressive in their recruiting, so that in the military and other areas, so that basically more and more federal dollars were funneled in that direction. So the Obama administration took a hard look at this and said, very understandably, if we're putting so much federal taxpayers into these schools, we want to see if the students are actually benefiting and what are the outcomes, are there quality outcomes that are coming out of it. So the administration came up with a number of reforms through a regulatory process. A couple of those reforms did go through in a pretty strong way, including some challenges to the way that the schools do their recruiting. But the main reform, which was basically to have schools that are required to prepare students for gainful employment, have to show in some way that they really are preparing people for gainful employment. And that was the so-called gainful employment regulation. Started out as a pretty strong proposal that the Obama administration came up with, and there was so much lobbying and so much activity by the for-profit industry, advertising, all sorts of lobbyists they hired, that eventually the rule that came out of the process was watered down significantly.
Well, the person in charge that was Obama's friend at the White House, Cass Sunstein, and he appears to have rolled over for this onslaught of lobbying. Didn't the for-profit industry hire mostly Democratic lobbyists? You know, some of the big prominent Democrats in town, in Washington.
Yeah, they sure did, and not just Democrats from Clinton administration and others, but also, you know, those who used to work actually at the Department of Education itself. So they had sort of a whole team of people that really put on the hard press, and unfortunately, it worked. And part of it, interestingly, was demonizing the short sellers on Wall Street, people like Steve Eisman and others who were warning of this problem, and they actually sort of demonized them as part of the process, sort of changed the subject in a lot of ways, because regardless of the source of the information, what some of the Wall Street short sellers were putting forth was actually accurate information showing how poorly these schools were performing.
So how is it then that we had one of the Republican presidential candidates who dropped out because he couldn't even remember his own policies? He was jokingly referred to as the candidate for those Republicans who thought George W. Bush was too cerebral. I refer to Governor Perry, who, when asked what government departments he wanted to ban, he remembered the Commerce Department and the Education Department, but couldn't remember the third one. Now, what is it about these Republicans who want to get rid of the Department of Education, whereas somebody like John Boehner, who's a huge champion for these for-profit colleges, isn't that where all the money comes from? I mean, I'd like to know, and I don't know whether you have the figures, Deanne Lunan, what percentage of the budget of the Department of Education goes into this for-profit college racket. That's my word, racket, not yours. You don't have to agree with me.
Yeah, no, I don't know the exact figures of aid. It's somewhere around 8 or 9% of all students actually attend these schools, but somewhere in the vicinity of 20% or maybe more than that of the aid goes to the schools, and that sort of those numbers have changed over time. So that's the way we can really measure is the federal aid dollars, and that's just from the Department of Education. That doesn't count, for example, the aid that goes to these schools to the Department of Defense as part of the new GI Bill, and there was a new study that Senator Harkin just announced today where they looked at how much of the Department of Defense aid is actually going to the for-profit schools. So there's a lot of federal money going to these schools, and that's why their lobbying is so strong. They want to keep that money coming. And frankly, the for-profit industry gives money to policymakers on both sides of the aisle. It's not just the Republicans. And so why they would want to abolish the Department of Education, or at least some of them would, I'm not sure. But I think those who particularly are working or getting a lot of funds from the for-profit industry probably really, really don't want the Department of Education to disappear.
So is it about $40 billion a year that taxpayer subsidies going to for-profit, or is it more than that? Do you have a figure?
I don't know the exact figure, because you also want to count in, as I said,
the Department of Defense,
all the different agencies. And then there's also state money going to the schools as well.
So you're, Deanne Noonan, again, attorney with the National Consumer Law Center and the director of the National Consumer Law Center Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. What can be done for these students that as I mentioned, get saddled with debt where U.S. taxpayer funds are then marked up heavily by these for-profit colleges, and whether or not the diploma is any good, the statistics are fairly clear that the graduates of these schools have a hard time getting jobs. And they've got all this huge debt. Give us a sense of where the relief is. You said there's some bright spots here.
Yeah, and there is. And we work with some borrowers, some low-income borrowers directly, although it's a limited number, and we have a website with more information. If you have a federal student loan, a government loan, there are actually quite a few options. As I mentioned, there's the possibility of canceling the loan, although those really apply in very limited circumstances. But if you went to a school that closed, for example, while you were there, you can get the loan eliminated, and there are some other limited ways that you can do that. If you can't cancel the loan, and this is what applies to most borrowers, whether you're in default or not, there are ways to get out of default, if you are in default, and get into an affordable repayment plan, and this is basically the income-based repayment plan that the Congress passed and just a couple of years ago. In some cases, a lot of my clients, for example, have payments that are zero under the income-based repayment plan. Obviously, they're not paying their loans off when you have a zero payment, but at least they're current. They don't have to worry about the government coming after them. They can go back to school if that's what they're hoping to do and get new loans and grants. And the government will actually forgive the balance, but not until after you've paid for 25 years, if there is a still balance after that, and that's actually going to go down to 20 years. So basically with the government loans, there are those kinds of options. Some are better than others, but at least there are ways to manage the debt. On the private loan side, unfortunately, you're basically at the mercy of your lender. There's no comprehensive law like there is for federal government loans that says to the lenders, you must provide flexible payment or deferments or cancellations. Some private lenders will do that, but it's generally sort of a case-by-case negotiation process.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Deanne Noonan, and for the work that you do.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Deanne Lunan, who's an attorney with the National Consumer Law Centre and the director of the National Consumer Law Centre's Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. She assists attorneys representing low-income consumers and teaches consumer law to legal services, private consumer attorneys, and other advocates. Deanne is the author of the National Consumer Law Centre's publications, Student Loan Law and Guide to Surviving Debt, as well as numerous reports on the student loan industry and borrower issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.